Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
Improving diversity and inclusion seems to be high on the priority list for Irish businesses as we pull out of the pandemic. This isn't a new topic by any means and has been gaining momentum at an employment level steadily over the last decade or so. However, there is still a lot of work that needs to be done. On today's episode of the HR Room podcast, we're going to be exploring this area. And to do so, we've enlisted the help of Vesi Tashova, diversity and inclusion consultant and author of How Diversity and Inclusion Leaders Can Drive Measurable Results. Vesi was named by Hive Learning as one of 2019's most influential D&I leaders globally and as one of the UK's most influential D&I leaders in 2020. We're delighted to have you join us, Vesi.
Thank you so much.
We're also joined by none other than the founder and managing director of Insight HR and HR Room regular, Mary Cullen. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you, Sarah.
Vesi, we might kick things off by perhaps asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Sure, yeah. So I'm originally Bulgarian. I moved to Ireland 6 years ago. You know, at the time, I think Pantiblis was just voted Person of the Year. Leo Varadkar had just come out. The marriage referendum was to happen in about 6 months. It was a very, very exciting time to come to Dublin, to move to Dublin and, you know, have my home here.
And can you tell us a little bit about Vesi.com and the work you're doing at the moment?
Sure, yeah. So Vesi.com is diversity and inclusion and mental health services. I work with organizations across North America and Europe. Companies like SoundCloud, Typeform, Reward Gateway. These are tech companies. Not all of my clients are in tech. I work across geographies and across industries. And maybe it's a bit selfish, but this keeps me intrigued. So the companies are not too similar. And it allows me to also bring more know-how from maybe like industries or geographies that they haven't been exposed to because they don't compare themselves to organizations that are not considered their immediate peers.
Definitely keeps things interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mary, what do you think the relationship is between diversity and inclusion and HR?
Yeah, well, I guess from a HR perspective, people want to work for employers with good employment practices and they want to feel valued in the places in which they work. So from an attraction and a talent perspective, as well as a corporate reputation perspective, diversity and inclusion is very important. From a HR perspective, if you're lucky enough and you have a big enough HR department, you may have somebody who's entirely dedicated to diversity and inclusion and is the person responsible for, person or team responsible for diversity and inclusion in the organization. And if you're in a standalone role, maybe it's part of the HR brief and you're trying to introduce various initiatives and programs and awareness raising campaigns, training and development, coaching for line managers. It's more difficult, obviously, the smaller the HR team. But it's very important in terms of talent, retention, attraction, reputation. And also when it comes to conflict in the workplace and disputes in the workplace, in many cases, HR are tasked with resolving the kind of issues that might arise when the ugly side of, you know, people's attitudes and biases and prejudices come into play in the workplace.
And Fessy, like, we almost always see diversity and inclusivity being grouped together. But what exactly do each of those terms mean? And do you think that an organization can ever be one without being the other?
That's a good question. Let's say, you know, with the diversity, it's what we are in terms of representation. So kind of like the demographics of the employee population. Or even just like the three of us right now, you know, we represent a certain, you know, on a certain level of diversity in terms of, you know, maybe gender, maybe sexual orientation, maybe generations or what abilities we have, you know, like differently abled, visible, invisible disabilities, etc. It could be, you know, what our, you know, cognitively we're probably very different. Our skills, strengths lay in different areas. So an organization can be very diverse. It does not mean, however, that people feel like they belong. It could be that, you know, they come into work and they are expected to be a certain way, to be like the majority, whatever the majority is. You know, let's say, and I know a lot of Irish companies are listening, so maybe, you know, it's the majority is Irish employees. So are the non-Irish expected to be very much Irish? And, you know, what does it mean? Does it mean to be white? Does it mean that, I don't know, you need to speak Gaelic like Irish? Or does it mean you need to, I don't know, you know, whatever it is, celebrate certain holidays or it's a certain style of communicating, like giving each other feedback? Because that can look very differently in different cultures. So that is around the level of inclusion. Do people actually feel like they're included? Now, let's assume that we have an amazing level of inclusion. Everyone feels like they belong, but we don't have diversity. What would that look like? That's probably a monoculture where, you know, it's homogeneous. Everyone is very happy because they're basically with people who are very much like Ben. And that doesn't, then we, you know, we're lacking diversity, we lack the benefits of diversity, and it's really hard to innovate. It will be very easy to work together because we can just agree with each other because we don't bring different perspectives. So everyone will feel included. I mean, 10 out of 10, right? But the diversity piece will be missing. So we do need both. And every organization is in a different place. Some start with very homogeneous team. They don't see what the issues around inclusion are. Then they start maybe like hiring. So for example, I was working with a company where for 5 years, their engineering team had only men. So imagine being the first woman or gay person or black person, whatever, coming into such a space. It will be so uncomfortable for everyone. So ideally, you know, that's not our starting point. And especially, you know, we don't keep things for such a long time because then it's, you know, they had inclusion before, you know, let's say women having, you know, joining such a team. But is that the type of inclusion that you want in your organization, that, you know, you want to be the type of employer? It's really hard to be the first. So we need to be thinking early on when we establish a team that it's diverse by default so that the inclusion happens a bit more organically. It's much harder to work on that when, so let's say for 10 people or like who are your founders first, is that a diverse team on its own? Then when you're 10 people or 20 people, are you maintaining the level of diversity, increasing it, etc.? Because there are companies that reach maybe 100 people and you look at it, and, you know, maybe the leadership team is somewhat diverse, but then all of the heads of all of the departments are, they're very similar in their background and perspectives, even though their functions are very different. And it's natural that the hiring that happens under them reflects on who they are.
Thanks so much for explaining that. You put things really clearly there. What do you think are some of the challenges then that face organizations if they want to be more diverse and inclusive?
And depends on the size of the organization. Typically, like budget sometimes is a huge constraint for the organization, depending in which industry and you know what the size of the organization is, to what extent they're able to afford that. Now, to do D&I work, it doesn't mean you need to have a budget, especially when we are putting the foundations and things are happening organically, right? It's more expensive when we need to go back and kind of redesign the DNA of the company in a sense. You know, what are the values? What's the business strategy? And try to embed it there. So budget can be a constraint or it could be a challenge, especially when the leadership team doesn't understand why this is needed. Actually, the biggest challenges are around engaging the leadership team. Some organizations are, I would say, more fortunate than others in having leaders who not just say they believe in this, but they genuinely feel that in every cell of their body. That's a huge difference, because even when people try to tell you in the most sincere way that they care about this, you can sense it if they don't. And you know what? You know what's interesting in D&I? Sometimes people believe themselves when they say something like that, but they could as well be misleading themselves. And the others might be quicker to pick it up. Sometimes we can hear that in the language that leaders use. And they're like, oh, like, what do you mean you don't see color? That's, no, you should see color, because people are having different experiences. You can just like wipe out other people's experiences saying you don't see color. Or saying, let's say, we hire people with all kinds of weird names. That's an actual quote. Like, you can't say that. Like, you just, we hire everyone. Like, we hire people. Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about diversity and inclusivity, how can you really drive measurable results? Again, the leaders on board, I imagine, would be one of the key drivers there. What are some of the other drivers?
Yeah, it's very important to set very specific objectives and key results. Naturally, the OKRs approach, objectives and key results, really helps with that. So with all of my clients, I use an OKR platform. It's called GKM Hub. And all of the work that we do there allows us to keep an eye on, like, you know, what's our confidence rate in terms of how close we will hit like a specific target, or just how we're progressing with specific projects. And it could be around, auditing the culture of the organization or working on the strategy. And it also gives a level of transparency. And they often, organizations see for themselves that they're actually lacking this level of transparency for maybe in D&I or maybe in general. Because in D&I, very often, especially when there is, let's say, there is someone on the HR team doing the D&I work, part of their work, or part of their job, or maybe there is a dedicated person, or maybe there is a chief diversity officer in a bigger organization. They're very much expected to, I don't know, do miracles. And that's not how D&I works. Like, each one of us is part of this. And when we increase the level of transparency and when we use OKRs, people can see how everything connects, so that, you know, let's say mid-managers are not lost between, oh, these are my targets for, you know, the month or for the quarter, and I don't see how diversity and inclusion relate to any of the things that I actually need to work on to be successful. So when we show what the business strategy is, where diversity and inclusion falls into that, and how it, so basically think about it as like a, you know, mapping out the whole organization and seeing that at a glance, and then it correlates to the specific action each employee has, that makes it actionable and it makes it measurable and people can understand and be engaged, rather than, you know, something that can be very abstract to some people. You know, you will have some colleagues that are very numbers driven. You will have some colleagues that are, you know, that let's say understand nuances in emotions or, you know, communication, like let's say marketing positioning, etc. So they would be looking at a concept of, let's say, belonging in very different ways. For some of them, it can sound like fluff. For others, it can be a very meaningful and deep concept they can connect with. So by having quantitative and qualitative approach in the D&I work, we can actually engage people regardless of, you know, what they look like cognitively.
Mm-hmm. Where would you recommend organizations start, Bessie? Because, you know, I would agree with you in terms of, you know, we talk about diversity and inclusion. It's a huge topic amongst HR practitioners. And yet, you know, there is that ugly side that I see where somebody is making a complaint against a manager because of harassment or discrimination in some way, or they're actually making allegations against the organization and saying that they're being systematically discriminated against by the organization. Or you'll see it with women, you know, not represented at board level or senior management level within organizations. And yet they've got a diversity and inclusion program running right throughout the organization. And so, you know, I know there's a lot of brilliant work done here, and there's some really fantastic organizations that are really, you know, front running when it comes to diversity and inclusion. And there's lots of others that talk it. But in reality, if you're working there in that organization, and you have a baby and you're female and you know that you're not going to go any further, or, you know, getting in place essential tools and equipment that you need if you're differently abled to get your work done, and it's impossible just to get the simple things in place. And I see that all over Ireland and the UK in organizations that talk about diversity and inclusion, but actually, you know, in real terms, as an employee who's working there, you're dealing with bias, unconscious or deliberate, and, you know, it may be affecting you in at a really individual level. So where should organizations start if they're very serious about changing attitudes in their organizations?
The CEO. You need to start from the top in many ways. One of them is the business strategy. Where does D&I fit within the business strategy? Like you mentioned earlier, you know, we can structure it around talent, you know, attracting talent, retaining talent. We can think about it through like our products or services. Are we innovating? How are we collaborating as teams? So do we have balanced teams? It could be, you know what, it corresponds to our values. It's the right thing to do. Maybe one of our values is empathy. So it's a very natural extension to that. Maybe we look at it as a part of, you know, our plans for expansion. Maybe like entering new markets, acquiring new customer segments, you know, so understanding better the customer needs. So it can be anything. It could be the accessibility of the products. It really depends on us, like what we're doing. In that sense, with D&I, we need to be very, aware of the context, especially as a consultant coming in. Like, you know, I can't have the same approach. On a high level, some things could look somewhat similar, but actually, once you go into them, we're working with different hypotheses. Every organization is extremely different. Their history has been different. Their values are different. The stakeholders are very different company by company. So, you know, back to your question, where do we start? We start at the top with the executive team. How engaged the CEO is, determines not only what budgets we'll have, but what engagement we'll have, to what extent the leadership team, the executives will be role models of what we're doing. So if the leaders, understand this and they advocate this, we won't probably have a lot of the issues you talked about. If they genuinely advocate for this, because people would know that kind of behavior will not be allowed, and it doesn't have to be, then we don't need policies that say, you know, you need to do this, or if you do this, there will be this kind of negative consequence for you. It's just people pick up on it. Similarly to the way, you know, kids pick up their parents' behavior. If the parents are saying, you know, oh, we don't eat chocolate before dinner, but then you see the parents kind of like sneaking in a piece of chocolate before dinner, well, it looks like we can all say that we don't do this, but you can do it secretly. And that happens in organizations. So kind of like double standards, and that doesn't really motivate the rest of the people in the organization. And police see that. Police, kids are not stupid. Employees are also not stupid. Not to imply that the employees are kids, but in terms of the role model dynamics. Now, in some organizations, we can see that the initiatives are driven from the bottom up, so like grassroots initiatives. If they have support from the leadership team, if they get the, you know, the funding that they need, that is great. They're always complementing each other. If an organization is exclusively relying on grassroots movements, or even just being like, oh, we're not interested in that, but we will let them do whatever they want, it's a broken system. Like, D&I is something that needs to happen at all levels by everyone. It's not the job of the HRs. It's not the job of, the chief diversity officer. It's everyone's job. Everyone needs to do a little bit of something. So using approaches where we can decentralize this engagement and education and participation, all of that is very important. So people can feel it's part of the NDA of the organization. DNA.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I
have more coffee.
Oh, I understand.
Very jealous of your coffee.
I didn't get around to getting one yet today. I
haven't had one yet either.
I think it's interesting when it comes to, you know, understanding that you've got to start at the top and influence at the top. And, you know, from a coaching and feedback perspective, when you're dealing with a CEO, do you have any tips for HR people? Because obviously it often starts there in terms of initiative. As you say, there's the grassroots initiative, and then you have HR driving a particular agenda too. But do you have any tips for, you know, HR when they're in that influencing position in terms of how coaching and feedback to the CEO might go?
Yeah, show numbers. Usually people tend to, like, if you go with a specific scenario and you say, oh, this and this happened, for some reason, the way we work as humans is we go, oh, that is an exception. That doesn't happen in general. That just happened once. That's where, let's say, when I do an audit in an organization, people can see what are the numbers. Does it happen to just one? Is it really the exception that they think? Or does it happen to 10% of people or 30% of people? How does it impact their sense of inclusion, the experience level of inclusion? How does it impact their engagement as employees? And we can see, you know, consistent connection between those by employee segment. Or let's say we don't have that level of data, we haven't done an audit yet. Let's look at the employee engagement. Let's look at who is joining the company and who is leaving the company. That can tell us a lot. If we have, let's say, 50% men, 50% women joining, but then the people who are leaving are actually, the majority are non-white women and women, and very rarely men, and, you know, white men, then, you know, it starts to look like there is a trend. So let's dive into it. What are people saying in the exit interviews? Do they feel comfortable talking during the exit interviews? Like, racism can be very subtle. Sometimes we just think that racism is if we say slurs, or we start, you know, I don't know, we jump on someone and, you know, we're physically abusive to them. We can be emotionally abusive to each other. And sometimes that's silence. Sometimes that's, you know, just not talking to that employee, because subconsciously we think they're so different, nothing connects them with us. We don't ask them to be part of our team on a, let's say, on client project and so on. So they're, you know, we don't have to be violent or deeply disrespectful to actually foster, kind of actually like nurture an environment where racism is becoming a problem. So we need to look at the numbers and see what trends are there. And then when we have, you know, let's say exit interviews, you know, hopefully we don't wait until people are leaving, but let's say we're doing those exit interviews, do we have a sense that people are comfortable sharing with us? It's very hard, you know, in this example, for a person of color to tell a white person, you know, I've been experiencing racism, and it could be silent racism, because you ask, oh, what happened? And you say, well, exactly, like nothing happens. Like I'm consistently like ignored, or like there are small comments here and there. When the person you're reporting to lacks those personal experiences to hear the nuances, to understand how painful they are and how those microaggressions have been consistently happening in the organization. So people tend to underreport that, which affects, you know, our numbers. So, you know, where do we start? But definitely going to the leadership team, or like to the CEO, we want to show some numbers and start from there. Once we show the numbers, they'll see there is a problem on whatever level we have data, and then we can understand better why are those numbers there, and get more in detail. Okay, so it's not just, you know, female employees or whatever, it's actually, you know, by group and so on. In Ireland, if you are a Black Irish person, you're still not considered Irish, mm-hmm. even if you speak Irish. It's like, it's not good enough. So like, so, you know, that's just one example. We can go by it, by, you know, like disabilities or whatnot.
Yeah. Interestingly, my own mother was from Birmingham, but of Irish descent, and came to Ireland in her early 20s. And always, you know, we experienced in the local community those kind of taunts about us being English, having been born and bred in Ireland, and you know, that those kind of, as you say, those little comments that people make, those like snide little remarks, and some of them as jokes, but all of them, you know, intended, and some of them maybe not intended. But as an individual, I know my mother would have felt it all her life, despite living in Ireland for, you know, 50 years of her life versus 20 in the UK.
Well, I bet those jokes were not making you laugh, no. Right? Maybe they were jokes for the person telling those supposedly jokes. So if, you know, if you don't find them funny, then they're no jokes.
Yeah.
And very often, especially in the workplace, you say, oh, you know, this person didn't mean anything bad, it was just a joke. Well, I don't see the person who was the object of those supposedly jokes to find this funny. They actually find it hurtful. They don't feel safe, you know, and so on. So that is problematic, or they just feel disrespected.
It comes back, doesn't it, though? Like, if you point out to somebody that's wrong, versus coaching and helping them to understand, I think there's a big difference in terms of how people receive those messages. And certainly when it comes back to the heart of training and teaching managers in particular to, I suppose, spot those kind of issues, reflect on their own behaviours, and learn to create that inclusive culture.
Yeah, it depends who's doing the education, because if we expect the underrepresented folks to do the education, so it's not only that, you know, they're constantly experiencing things that are basically implying their place is not there, and sometimes it's, you know, they're told that in very straightforward way. But then expecting them to, so they have the emotional work around coping with what's happening, but also then having to go the further mile to educate the person on that, like, it's not a fair expectation.
Yeah.
So just if we think about, you know, let's say productivity of the employees, you know, one person is just, you know, just doing their job. They have 100% of their capacity to do, you know, whatever they need to. And another person is consistently facing microaggressions of various degree, or like maybe even more serious situations. You know, of course, it affects them emotionally, let's say 20%, 30%, but then also spending time to educate someone, like what they're not responsible to educate all of your employees one by one. So like that's a full-time job, you know, maybe for L&D people or D&I people. And for the leadership team to actually be the role model. So it's a very fine balance for the object of, let's say, the joke or whatever, to be able to say, hey, that's not okay. If they feel comfortable, that already suggests a certain level of safety of the organization, that if they come to HR, HR will not say, oh, come on now, that was just a joke. But they would say, yeah, we hear you. I think you were right to call this person out. We'll also have a chat and, you know, explain that this is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, I mean, at Insight HR, we do a lot of workplace investigations. And it's only when things are critical from the employee perspective that they may raise their hand. So I agree with you entirely. It is the responsibility of the organization to create that safe and inclusive and nurturing culture, and not from the individuals. But the practicalities when it comes to dealing with bias and dealing with attitude at an organizational level, the coaching and the feedback that managers are giving people becomes critical in terms of ensuring that it is a safe place for people to work, and an inclusive place for people to work.
Essie, over the last year, it really seems like this has become more of a priority for many businesses. Like, why do you think that is?
There have been a few major factors. One of them, the pandemic, you know, people becoming much more aware of what their state of mental health is. You know, dealing with loneliness, not being able to communicate, collaborate with people the way they used to. Then the killing of George Floyd came to the forefront. You know, Stop Asian Hate as well. Like, there has been a lot going on globally. So the urgency has been increasing, and I think people were losing patience. When I say people, I also mean the employees in organizations. Hence, businesses like need to speed up things, because let's say the last 3 years they have been saying, yeah, like, we'll do something, we'll do it next Q and next Q and next Q, and yeah, it's an important topic for us. And I think many people have had enough. Everyone is asking for basic stuff, just, you know, to have equal opportunities in the workplace, to be treated equally, and it should be basic, it should be there by default. So when you see that, when, you know, when it manifests in such huge ways, like the killing of George Floyd, it's hard to just keep going, and people need to speak up, and they do, and, you know, so that created a lot of momentum.
Yeah, I remember when that happened, the killing of George Floyd, and then a few days later, a lot of businesses started posting the black squares on their Instagram channels and on their LinkedIn and on their social media. And actually, I think that prompted a lot of interest in discussions as well, because it sort of had a little bit of a backlash almost on some organizations that might have posted this, but didn't actually have they hadn't got any proof that they were actually really valuing diversity and inclusivity and really practicing what they preach. So they might have been posting this kind of black square to show solidarity, which is great, but behind that, there might not have necessarily been any strategies in place. And I think that prompted quite a lot of interest in discussions as well. But you work with like a wide variety of clients in industries, SoundCloud, Typeform, Reward Gateway. Do you have a tried and tested approach that you take? Is that a silly question? Does it differ from client to client?
So it's a bit of both, in the sense that, you know, during the discovery phase, you know, the things that I need to learn about the organization, like, it's very, very different. As I was saying earlier, you know, the history of a specific organization, not just in terms of D&I, but, you know, who were the founders? You know, how long was that ago? Were they replaced by a brand new leadership team? How did the organization react to that? Are some of the founders still part of the leadership team? You know, what are the values? Are they very like results oriented, kind of aggressive in their nature? Are there things like, you know, like empathy, belonging, you know, like we're a team, we help each other, or is it about, you know, the performance of the individual? Does it put customers first over employees' well-being, or the opposite? The employees' well-being comes in first, and then the customers, you know, customer success, or how do we balance between those two? So in the discovery phase, you know, it could be anything. It really, really depends. Also, what is the most acute pain that are currently coming to me for? Is it also like, why are they coming now? Why not 2 years ago or 2 years from now? So this is all very critical. Now, when we do the audit, there are universal steps we go through. But even in that, you know, what are the hypotheses that we have in place? And they're very different company by company. The things that we're guessing that might be barriers to inclusion, and then how do we explore that to validate them or to see that, you know, they're actually not true? Then who they get benchmarked against is very different company by company. What trends and patterns do I see across your organization? What are let's say, like, you know, like, so everything that we see on all of those levels is extremely different. Also, like, when I talk to the employees, you know, how many employee segments do we want to focus on? 3, 7, 15? Because that also shapes like how many interviews I will be doing in an organization to have like a, you know, a good qualitative insight into what's happening. And then the strategy can be completely different based on all of those previous steps. So there is, for the audit and strategy, there are similarities, but the content that actually, you know, is developed and what we look at is very, very unique. Let's say the ethnicities will be different by geography. So the people I would be talking to in terms of employee segments would also be very different. But it also depends on the organization. Do they see, let's say it's an Irish company. Do they have any travelers in the organization? Do they see that as an important enough employee segment so that they say, we want you to interview this group of people as well, so that we know how they feel specifically versus, let's say, you know, the other groups. Mm-hmm. There is a core report on experience discrimination in the context of like housing. And when you look at the groups, you know, you see a breakdown by age, gender, if you're single or married, if you have kids, if you have any disabilities, if you're Irish, Black, Asian, and whatnot. But for example, it didn't take into account that you can be Black and Irish at the same time. So, you know, if an organization is coming to me and they say, you know, like, talk to some Irish, you know, let's say Irish employees are one employee segment, and then people of color or just non-Irish people are another segment, like, then what's our definition of, you know, Irish? And sometimes that comes from the client. Sometimes it comes from me in the sense of, you know, I would make my recommendations, but it also depends where they are in their maturity. And naturally, if we're adding more segments, it becomes more expensive for them. Mm-hmm. So what's the level of detail they want to have? Some organizations could want a significant number of employee segments to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. And that could be despite the fact that they're, let's say, relatively small. Let's say they're 200 people. They might want the depth that an organization of maybe 1,000 employees is looking at, because it's important for them.
And when you're engaged to do that kind of work, Fessy, you come in and through a range of different tools, including individual interviews or focus group interviews, you audit the company and their practices and make recommendations. And what happens then? Do you continue to work with the organization around awareness raising campaigns, around training and development, around other measures that you might put in place for specific groups that are underrepresented within the organization or whose voice isn't being heard? What kind of role do you play after the audit, or is it specific to the audit?
In most, if not all, the cases, the audit is not just on its own. It comes with a strategy, with a strategy proposal, or like with, let's say, educational program proposal, depending on, you know, what the scope and focus is. So I don't just give them some recommendation, you know, like, oh, you need to do a bit more of, you know, blah, because this is not actionable for the clients. They don't know what to do with that. So they have like a strategy proposal or like educational program proposal or a combination of both, again, whatever the scope is. So I support them in also even like communicating that to the employees. I take open Q&A session. I encourage my clients to share the report that I create with the employees so they can see that they were heard, that their experiences are not ignored, that the leadership team knows about them, and they can ask open questions on the follow-up, you know, actions and like the projects that are being planned. So with the client, like I can be supporting them with the specific projects. Some of them might want to be more hands-on and do, you know, execute the strategy on their own. So in terms of level of implementation, how much support they want, it varies client by client. There is also the case where, you know, I see the need of work in a specific area where I'm not a domain expert. So let's say they're lacking, you know, basic knowledge of, let's say, hiring people with disabilities. You know, I wouldn't be giving them a training where, like, I wouldn't be familiar with the legal, you know, like restrictions or like whatever is in place in the specific country. So I have a network of experts that I bring in for the specific projects where, you know, like D&I has so many dimensions, you can be an expert in everything. So knowing how much I know and kind of bringing someone who can not just compliment, but can lead me in those is very important.
And Vessi, like if somebody wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do so?
Vessi.com. Or you can just shoot me an email at Vessi@Vessi.com.
That's brilliant. That's about all we have time for today, I'm afraid. And it's a shame because it's actually such a really interesting and diverse topic as well. There's a lot of stuff in it. I might just try, and it's going to be difficult, but I might just try and go back over some of the key takeaways that I've kind of got from today's show. So key takeaway number one is that diversity and inclusion is heavily related to HR. Employees want to feel valued, and if they feel included, then that will help retention rates and also attraction rates. And HR also needs to be aware of diversity within an organization when it comes to conflict management, being aware of kind of both conscious and unconscious bias and how that can affect certain situations. My key takeaway number two is that there are some challenges when it comes to kind of improving on D&I strategies or creating a D&I strategy. One of those challenges is budget. As Vessi mentioned, you don't necessarily need a budget if things are happening organically. But if you do need to go back and review the company's D&A, the organization's D&A, then that could end up adding up the costs. And also engagement from leaders, that can be a little bit of a challenge too. Leaders might really feel that they are on board with D&I initiatives and genuinely feel that, but they might not really, or they might still have some unconscious biases that they're not quite aware of. And then my third and final takeaway is when it comes to driving results. So have specific objectives that you can track, and also be transparent so that people can see how everything connects and can see that their targets really do affect the overall strategy. So make things actionable and measurable. This will help with engagement. And remember that it starts with the CEO and the executive team. So they'll have a huge influence on how successful any resulting strategy will be. They're going to need to lead by example and show what is tolerated and not tolerated. Also on a practical level, CEO kind of controls the budget there. So even though you might not need a budget if it's happening organically, as we mentioned, if you do need to go back and kind of start from the beginning, then that might require some investment in training and strategy. And with all that said, it is everyone's job. So everyone needs to be on board, hence why engagement is critical. So that was difficult to try and kind of capture the takeaways from today's episode, because it has been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today, Vessi. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.